Welcome to the October edition of National Geographic Kids. I am Chris Radio volunteer Linda Lydon. The front cover of this month's magazine features a dinosaur. Weird but true. Check out these outrageous facts. For 23 years, it was illegal for women to wear pants in Paris, France. Horseradish is a member of the mustard family. Scientists think sharks are colorblind. A Chiweenie is a mix that's part Chihuahua and part Dachshund. People tend to sleep less during a full moon. A golf ball has about 300 dimples. A turtle shell is made up of about 50 bones. The gray catbird makes a meow sound. And a group of ice floes that looks like an iceberg is called a floeberg. Big question. Why do animals shed their fur? Many mammals need thick fur to stay toasty in the winter and thin fur to keep chill in the summer. So sort of like you do when the seasons change, they switch coats. But instead of wearing a heavier or lighter jacket, animals shed their fur to make room for a new coat. Changes in the amount of sunlight in the fall and spring trigger the animal to lose old hair and grow a new coat that's right for the season. For some critters, shedding helps them camouflage. Arctic foxes and Arctic hares swap a white winter look for a brown summer coat to blend in better with their surroundings. Pets, cats, and dogs also shed, but seasons aren't the only thing that determine how much fluff they lose. Genes do too. Traits like hair and eye color, height, and how much fur one sheds are determined by genes passed from parents to their babies. For instance, Siberian huskies were bred to survive in the tundra, where temperatures are often freezing. They have a double coat or long outer coat and thick undercoat, which sheds a lot. But short-furred chihuahuas, originally bred in locations where year-round warmer weather, shed less. So if you live somewhere snowy, your chihuahua might need a doggy coat on his walk. Moment of dance. Male cottonger dancing frogs are only about an inch long. To stand out in rocky streams in Indian forest, these frogs lift and shake their back legs in a move called foot flagging. This messages to other males, back off. That's a wrap. Male adlers in Europe and Asia wrestle each other for a mate. Scientists call the move the Dance of Adders. We call it a snake smackdown. Winging it. The synchronized steps of a red-crowned crane help keep these birds bonded for life. In pairs, the East Asian cranes bob their heads and run together with their wings outstretched in a romantic ballet. Strut their stuff. If a female blue-footed booby likes the color of a male's feet, the bluer the better, she joins him in high-stepping strut. Then the pair nest on one of the islands off the Pacific coast of Central and South America. Talk about putting your best foot forward. Bet you didn't know. Six facts about black and white animals. Fact number one. Chinstrap penguins take over 10,000 naps a day. Fact two, giant pandas and lions have a similar bite strength. Fact number three, striped skunks can spray their target from 20 feet away. Fact four, from longer distances, zebras look gray to predators like spotted hyenas. Fact five, female orcas can live up to 90 years in the wild. And fact six, some clownfish are black and white instead of orange. Amazing animals. Cat video in space. This comes from deep space. This funny cat video is out of this world. A kitty named Taters starred in the first video sent from deep space, the part of the space that starts just beyond the moon. NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory, which uses robotics to explore space, wanted to test the possibility of using a laser to transmit ultra-high-definition videos across deep space. So Taters' owner, a NASA employee, recorded the tabby chasing, what else? A laser. Then the team put the video file onto a spacecraft that NASA launched to explore an asteroid. The 15-second video was successfully transmitted 19 million miles back to the lab on Earth in just 101 seconds. This technology might one day help scientists learn more about planets like Mars and Venus. Taters is ready to help with more space experiments, owner Jacoby Harris says, but only if they're in between naps. Come back, critter. Pygmy hog. This comes from Assam, India. Baby hogs, as tiny as a newborn kitten, run behind their cat-sized mom through grass that's taller than they are. These cuties are pygmy hogs, the smallest and rarest species of wild pig. Pygmy hogs had nearly gone extinct by the 1980s as their grassland habitat disappeared to make room for cattle grazing, farming, and other human activities. To save the hogs, the Dural Wildlife Conservation Trust, the Indian government, and other groups brought six wild animals into captivity to begin a breeding program. Since then, the conservationists have raised and released over 170 pygmy hogs into four protected areas. Recently, a hidden camera caught a picture of a family providing some of the released proving some of the released hogs are having babies. I'm so excited. I was jumping, program director Pargar Thak says. It was a moment we were waiting for. That's something to squeal about. Dog mom snuggles wild pups. This comes from South Bend, Indiana. A group of newborn African wild dogs wiggled and squirmed up close to Casey, the golden retriever. They're sharing her warmth and milk with the mama's seven pups as they lay together at the Port-a-Mami Zoo hospital floor. The wild dogs' mom couldn't feed them or keep them warm, which isn't uncommon for the first-time mamas. So zoo staff called a local animal shelter to find a foster mom for these endangered pups. We were so excited to find a golden retriever because they're about the same size as African wild dogs, zoo curator Jamie Richard says. We knew the wild pups would fit right in with her pups, slurped Casey's milk and snoozed alongside the pups for 23 days. When the wild pups started playing rough with the goldens, they were ready to join the zoo and other wild dogs. Casey and her pups were later adopted, so all of the dogs got a tail-wagging happy end. How to build a dinosaur. Near a murky river that cuts through what's now southwestern Utah, a dinosaur larger than two school buses checks out its surroundings. The 40,000-pound creature is watching for predators, ready to use its strong whip-like tail to defend itself. Once it feels safe, the prehistoric plant eater lumbers towards nearby bushes for a snack. Some 150 million years later, paleontologists dug up the parts of this dino, a new sauropod species that's yet to be named. Sauropods are long-necked plant-eating dinosaurs. Discovering a dinosaur is only the first step in a long journey, paleontologist Louis Chippy says. Getting its bones from a dig site to a museum where people can learn about the animal takes a lot of time and effort. Let's keep reading to discover how scientists assembled the massive skeleton of this late Jurassic era creature. Step 1. Discover a dinosaur. Bones from the new sauropod species are first discovered in 2007 near the town of Bluff, Utah. Over the next 12 years, experts uncover hundreds of bones from different dinos belonging to the species. They decide to use the bones from six of these creatures to create one skeleton representing the new dinosaur. This small dig site, an area of about the size of one bedroom apartment, was consistently swarmed by biting gnats, Chippy says. So we called the skeleton we wanted to build Gnatville as a joke, but the name stuck. Based on the types of rocks surrounding Gnatville's bones, like the femur being measured below, Cheapy's team thinks the dig site was once an ancient riverbed. The bones' green color was caused by minerals in the water. Over centuries, water and weather moved all of these fossils together, he says. Step 2, transport the bones. After Gnatville bones are dug up, they're coated with what paleontologists call a plaster jacket. The super hard covering can take 3 days to apply to a large bone like the one below, a piece of Gnatville's spine. The plaster jacket protects the bones as it's lifted from the dig site by chains and carried away on a construction vehicle. The bone probably weighs 1,000 pounds, and the plaster surrounding it might weigh 600 pounds, says Chippy, pictured below on the tractor. Workers build a reinforced steel frame to support the bone as it's transferred to a flatbed truck, then driven to its next destination. Step 3, clean and label the bones. From Utah's Gnatville's bones are driven to the Natural History Museum of Los Angeles County in Los Angeles, California, where they'll eventually go on display. There, experts open and remove the plaster jackets from the bones and then clean the bones. Chippy, who's also the director of the U.S. Dinosaur Institute at the museum, says cleaning one large bone can take years. After the bones are cleaned, they're labeled, photographed, and added to the museum's digital archives. Step 4, make new bones. After the bones are cleaned, they're sent to a research casting international, RCI, in Trenton, Canada, where dinosaur mounting experts will assemble the 75-foot-long skeleton. But before the bones can be put together, missing pieces of the skeleton need to be created. It's rare to find all of the bones you need to create a skeleton, Chippy says. So the Canadian team prints any missing bones using Diplodocus for inspiration. The 3D bones are painted to match Gnatville's bones. Once all the bones are put together, Gnatville's skeleton will be 80% real bone. Step 5, mount the dinosaur. It's time to assemble the skeleton. First, welders or workers who join metals together build steel structures that will support the bones as they're connected. Then they secure individual bones to the steel frame with small pieces of removable metal called armatures. Later, they'll bend the steel frame to follow the shape of Natsville's body. Finally, all the metal will be painted to match the skeleton's coloring. Step 6, display it. After the mount is complete, the skeleton is taken apart. The mounting in Canada is like a dress rehearsal for what will go up in the museum, Chippy says. It has to be taken apart before it can be shipped back. The skeleton is taken apart into 300 pieces, each individual bone plus its connected armature. Once the museum gets the skeleton back, it won't take long to connect the armatures back together. Sort of like putting Lego pieces together that you've already seen assembled, Chippy says. After 17 years of work, Natsville will finally go on display in the fall of 2024. And then it's on to the next dinosaur, Chippy says. Who knows what other creatures are out there waiting to be found? Life of a fossil. Usually when an animal dies, its flesh gets eaten or decays, and the skeletons turn to dust. But not always. Sometimes dead creatures become fossils, or the preserved remains of ancient organisms. Most fossils are discovered near places where ancient bodies of water used to be. Let's read on and discover why. First, an animal dies near a lake, river, or ocean. Second, water washes sand or mud over the dead animal so its skeleton isn't broken down by wind or rain. Third, over thousands of years, minerals seep into the remains and fossilize the bones. Layers of rocks called strata form over the skeleton. And fourth, the fossil eventually pushes up to the surface as the ground shifts, ready to be discovered. Tools of the trade. Workers at the Utah site use lots of low-tech gadgets to dig up parts of the dino's neck and tail base. A canopy provides shade from the sun. B, buckets, brooms, and dustpans keep the dig site clean. C, workers kneel on knee pads that cushion the rocky ground. D, shovels and picks dig and split rocks. E, chisels and hammers split rocks and chip away at delicate material. F, jackhammers remove hard material surrounding bones. And G, a special glue repairs minor breakage in fossils. These are actually chocolate. Check out some tasty creations from around the world. This chocolate looks way too good to eat. After all, you wouldn't want to destroy these replicas of landmark sculptures by chocolate makers called chocolatiers. Here's how the models stack up against the real-life historical hotspots. The Leaning Tower of Pisa. In 1173, builders in Pisa, Italy, began to work on a grand bell tower to show off the city's wealth. But the tower was built on soft soil. After workers finished the second floor, one side of the building began to sink into the dirt. Builders tried different ways to straighten out the structure, such as adding more marble to the non-sinking side. Nothing worked. By the time it was complete in 1399, the 8-story site had been dubbed the Leaning Tower of Pisa. To prevent the tower from collapsing, its foundation was reinforced with supporting materials, and only a few visitors can be in it at a time. Building blocks. The real deal, limestone and marble. The sweet treat. 1,400 pounds of white chocolate. How long it took? The real deal, over 200 years. The sweet treat, 15 days. How big is it? The real deal, 185 feet tall. Sweet treat, 5 feet tall. The sculpture used white chocolate because it's easier to mold than other flavors. And because the real tower is white. The Great Wall of China. Emperor Qin Shi Huang, who led China around 220 BC, wanted to guard his land from invaders. So he ordered the construction of a wall along what was then China's borders. Peasants, disgraced noble and prisoners, built the site out of stones and dirt bricks, which they pounded into place with their hands. In one section, workers used a glue-like substance made from sticky rice to bind the bricks. That's better than what people once thought was the key ingredient, ground-up human bone. Work continued for the next 1,800 years. By 1644, the Great Wall, which is actually made of 16 separate sections, stretched over 13,000 miles. Building blocks? The real deal, stone, dirt, and mortar. The sweet treat, about 8 tons of milk and white chocolate. How long it took? The real deal, 1,800 years. The sweet treat, about 6 months. How big is it? The real deal, over 13,000 miles long, 6 to 26 feet tall. The sweet treat, 50 feet long and up to 8 feet tall. During the construction, grape syrup was mixed with the chocolate to give the sculpture a clay-like texture. The Temple of Kukulcan at Chichen Itza. Over 1,000 years ago, the Maya people reigned over parts of what is now Mexico and Central America. Around the 11th century, they started building a tower temple at the center of the Chichen Itza, the civilization's capital at that time. The temple was constructed to celebrate Kukulcan, a mighty god that was said to be a feathered serpent. Regular ceremonies were held on the top of the nearly 100-foot-tall building in the god's honor, and they included human sacrifices. But the spot wasn't just a worshiping site. By observing the way the sun hits the building through the years, the Maya of Chichen Itza were able to keep track of the seasons. The building blocks, the real deal, stone. Sweet treat, 18,244 pounds of milk chocolate. How long it took? The real deal, about 200 years. The sweet treat, almost 17 days. How big is it? The real deal, 32,400 square feet, 79 feet tall. The sweet treat, 10 square feet and 6 feet tall. Chocolatiers decided to sculpt a building inspired by the Maya because chocolate was a popular food in this civilization. St. Pascal's Cathedral. Ivan the Terrible, who ruled Russia from 1534 to 1584, ordered the construction of St. Basile's in Moscow to celebrate the capture of enemy land. But some say the structure almost burned down after French Emperor Napoleon Bonaparte invaded Russia in 1812. According to one legend, his army tried to set off an explosion to destroy it, to destroy St. Basile's. But a sudden rainstorm doused the fuse, preventing the destruction of the church. The building blocks? the real deal, white stone and brick. Sweet treat, about 100,000 pounds of white and milk chocolate. How long it took? The real deal, about 6 years. The sweet treat, about 4 months. And how big is it? The real deal, 156 feet tall. The sweet treat, about 8 feet tall. Many of the small chocolate pieces, such as the cross at the top of the church dome, were carved separately, then attached with super sticky chocolate glue. Ocean Explorers. Four tales of adventure aboard a ship that's built for science. All aboard the Ocean Explorer, a high-tech research vessel, scientists and adventurers lived on the ship while it sailed across the globe on a mission to uncover ocean secrets. Check out thrilling tales from the expedition. Tale number one, shark sighting. This comes from the Azores Islands in the Atlantic Ocean. We're hoping to tag a blunt-nosed six-gill shark, a species few people have ever seen in the wild. First, we'll need to lure a six-gill close enough to our submarine to tag it. We attach bait to the outside of our sub, but when a shark finally appears, she only snacks on the fishy bits that flaked off and are floating away from our vehicle. Later, two more six gills arrive. The sharks start to fight over the food, and one slams into the sub. One shark is close enough to tag, but it's moving so fast the scientist, Jorge Fontes, misses the fish. We only have one more chance. A female finally chomps the bait on the sub, and we tag her. A camera attached to the tag floats above the shark, recording what the creature sees for a few hours. The first footage of the shark captures a video of us celebrating. Adventure 2, Light Show, the Azores. We were 2,000 feet beneath the ocean surface, and the water around the submarine is pitch black. I'm with my fellow deep-sea biologist, Edith Wider, who has an idea. Maybe by flashing the bright lights on our subs, we can cause a chemical reaction in the small creatures that are floating by, which would allow us to see them. When animals produce its own light, it's called bioluminescence. We'll try the experiment in a few spots. We tried the experiment in a few spots with no luck. Then suddenly, flash, hundreds of tiny dots of light appear as the critters react to our sublights for a moment. I feel like I'm wrapped in a blanket of stars. Adventure 3, polar bear close up. This comes from Svalbard Islands in the Arctic Ocean. I'm helping wildlife veterinarian Rolf Arne Omenberg examine a tranquilized polar bear in the Arctic. The surrounding air is an icy cold, but the bear's body feels oven hot beneath my hands. Its breath comes out as a stinky stream. We measure its dinner plate size paws and check its teeth. Then we take blood samples. Scientist John Ayers will use the samples to find out what this adult male has been eating. As the climate warms, polar bears can't easily hunt seals off the ice, and we learn that one's been eating more reindeer and berries. Luckily, he's healthy, and we watch from afar as the polar bear wakes up. I imagine he's thinking, what just happened? Adventure 4, Whale Tale. It's 2 a.m. We're supposed to watch the footage. The whale dives so fast that most of the suction cups holding the camera to the creature's skin detached, flipping the device backwards. But we can see the whale's tail as it dives 2 miles deep. It swims back towards the surface, and then, a surprise, another whale swims into the frame, greeting its friend. We high-fived and hugged. All the late nights were well worth it. Chimp rescue. See how two BFFs are growing up at a primate sanctuary. An 18-month-old chimpanzee cowers with a rope around his waist. A poacher has killed his mother and brought him to the small village. Away from the chimp's forest home in a nearby community, a 20-month-old chimp has also lost her mother to poachers. The wildlife thieves want to sell these young apes into illegal pet trade. Just in time, rangers from the Okapi Wildlife Reservation in the Democratic Republic of Congo find the poachers and rescue the chimps. But the infants are unwell, lonely, and scared. They've likely eaten nothing but bananas and sugarcane, which doesn't give them the nutrients they need. Without proper care, the chimps won't survive. In the air, the rangers contact Liro Primates Rehabilitation Center to help these chimps, now named Felix and Mara. The orphans need to get to the center quickly, so workers call up Vertigo National Park to organize transportation. Soon, park pilot Anthony Caesar loads the pair into a small plane for the 90-minute flight. In the air, the chimps snuggle close to Caesar for comfort. Once the chimps arrive at the rehabilitation center, caretakers immediately give the youngsters a protein-rich drink. Then they're moved into their own room away from other chimps so they can adjust to their new surroundings. It's easier for chimps if they come in together, says Itso Balaz Dalbarku, the center's technical director. They can comfort each other. Getting settled. In the wild, young chimps are dependent on their moms until they're about 4 years old. So Felix and Mara need constant human attention. Caretakers bottle feed the youngsters and sleep beside them so they can give babies more formula if they wake up. During the day, the chimps often explore outside. This playtime is an important part of the youngsters' development. These chimps need to pick up the skills that they should have learned from their moms, Valdez Burgo Guinea says. It's up to us to help them learn. As the chimps grow healthier, they build trust with their caretakers. This bond makes it easier for humans to care for the youngsters. But as they age, they'll spend less time with people and more time with other chimps. A new family. After a few months, Mara and Felix meet other young chimps living at the center. Caretakers take it slow as the newbies greet other chimps through the bars of the enclosure, touching and smelling their future friends from a safe distance. At first, the other chimps are full of energy, which might feel overwhelming for the newcomers. After about 20 minutes, the excited apes start to relax. Once Felix and Mara feel comfortable, they test out the large playtime enclosure the other young chimps use. At first, only two other chimps are let in, then another two, and another two. Soon, all the young chimps join, and caretakers monitor the apes to make sure everyone is safe. After a few days, Felix and Mara fully join the crew, hanging out with their new pals all the time. As Felix and Mara get older, they'll have limited contact with humans, interacting with caretakers only at dinner time and during vet visits. Most often, their days will be spent with the other chimps in their large forested outdoor enclosure. These orphan apes have found their family. Monkeys or apes? People often use the word monkey to describe apes and vice versa. But these animals are not the same. Match the fact to the type of primate it describes. Hint, it could be both. Number one, they usually have tails. Is it a monkey, an ape, or both? It is a monkey. Number two, some species have furry faces. Monkey. Number three, in trees they prefer swinging over leaping. Apes. They have narrow chests. Monkey. Number five, their brains are large for their body size. Apes is the answer. Six, they can walk on two legs. Answer, apes. Most species use tools. Again, answer, apes. They live in Africa and Asia. Answer, both. They are found in Central and South America. Answer, monkeys. And they can grasp objects with their long fingers. Answer, both. This has been the October edition of National Geographic Kids. I'm a Chris Radio volunteer, Linda Lydon.